Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to the very last episode of Text Message, numbered in double digits, episode 99. UK-focused technology podcast, of course, we are. With me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And brought to you, as ever, for another week by you. Thank you so much to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UK Tech. If you're a patron, of course, this is your regular extended cut of this week's show with extra stories and discussion. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to get our extended cuts and other perks and support us every week, you can head to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/UK Tech to find out how you can support us for as little as just $1 per episode. Thanks to some new Patreons we've got this week from Fraculous, Tom Mannion, Stan Grip. Thank you very much, guys. And to everybody else, of course, who has been supporting us for the last few months. Now, as I noted just a few moments ago, if you remember, I made a little joke about how this was the last double-digit episode. That's because next week you'll hear episode 100, which we're very excited about. We're going to be taping it tomorrow, actually. Today that we're recording is Sunday. We're taping tomorrow. The reason we're taping it tomorrow is because we are doing it live in a studio in London with a full studio audience. It's going to be a slightly longer show. It's going to be in a pretty different format. It's going to have a full panel comprised of some of the finest examples of British tech and gaming journalists available at reasonably short notice. And we are super, super excited. It's going to be on video as well. And it's going to release at the normal time next week for episode 100, although I suspect we'll be releasing the video version a little bit earlier, perhaps for some of our patrons, but everyone will have access to it. We're not going to be charging anyone for it next week either for the people on Patreon. This is a bit of a celebration for us getting to this milestone first triple figure episode, and we want everybody to be a part of that. So extremely excited about that, and excited
it's
that some of our
very good
listeners are going to be joining us. What was that, Chief?
It's going to be extremely good. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's always nice to do something a little bit different, you know, with a podcast. And it hasn't been too painful to organise, has it?
It's not. It has been an enormous pain in the ass, I will say, for the last 3 weeks of logistic planning and writing. I mean, the show's script and outline is pretty detailed at this point. But no, it's been reasonably enjoyable to put together. I'm very excited about putting it out. It's going to be great. You're in for a real treat, so don't miss out. That's all I'll say. However, in the meantime, we are, of course, spending this week in our usual format, and we're going to start with some news. And we're actually going to start just briefly. I wanted to touch upon the WannaCry ransomware virus. We talked about this at length last week on episode 98. And if you want to have a little recap about how all that kicked off, how it affected our NHS system here in the UK, then I do recommend going back and listening to 98 if you haven't before. But what was quite great to see is that, I mean, on the one hand, there was a big fear that after the virus broke last weekend, there was going to be a resurgence of new attacks or copycat attacks this week. And I was really pleased to see that that didn't seem to happen. The NHS seemed to largely recover towards the early part of this week, and has, from what I've read recently, been basically back to normal. Certainly most of the NHS trusts affected were back to normal by the middle of the week. And the other interesting thing, I don't normally reference things that I write for my professional employment at Bloomberg, but I did write a story this week for Bloomberg about how the amount of money that the ransomware perpetrators had managed to collect on Bitcoin was actually low. When I wrote the story yesterday on Friday, they'd claimed an equivalent of about $90,000 worth of Bitcoin, which, given the spread, you know, we had over 200,000 reported infected machines globally, and by some of the huge and wealthy companies affected, you'd have thought that that would be a higher figure. It represents, I think, fewer than 200 total individual payments, given that they, you know, the amount that they each wanted. So it was very, very very not lucrative, let's say.
Well, I mean, you say that, but they didn't really have to do anything, did they? And they got a load of money.
Well, compared to what it could have raised, you know.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, that is a lot of money for one person to get. I mean, obviously, the penalty for being caught for having done it would be extensive based on the amount of crime done. But if you can work out a way of getting that money out and wandering off into the ether, but don't forget, you're not paying any tax on that. So, you know, that's 100 grand in your skyrocket for nothing.
I think paying tax on the ransomware is probably the least of the attackers' concerns. But I also chief among their concerns will be retrieving the money from the blockchain, from Bitcoin, because whilst the money is staying put and not being touched, it's damn near impossible to use the Bitcoin transactions to trace the attackers. But once they start touching that money, trying to move it, which I've seen conflicting reports, but everyone I spoke to last week on the expert side said, no, the money hasn't been touched in these three accounts. It's unlikely that they're going to want to move it, because it basically just gives them, it gives the legal authorities worldwide who are trying to find these people a clue as to where they might be. And
I mean, there must be a way of doing it though, mustn't there?
No.
It seems really.
Not unless they try and move the money, not really. The bigger clues are going to be found in the malware itself, I think. So,
yeah, probably.
You know, there were lots of really little things like, you know, the time code of the compiling date for, you know, one of the virus strains, you know, the sort of applications, if you like, it behind it. Things like how there were about 70 different variants of language used for the ransom based on where the attack was taking place, but that you know, some of the language read like a second language, whereas some read like a native speaker. And so trying to work out this, and there have been lots of speculation about it, and none of it really pertains to UK consumer tech. So we, you know, we'll leave it to others to go into more detail there. But I did want to point out, of course, just as a follow up, that we're pleased that the NHS is back to normal, and hopefully critical operations are resuming unaffected now. Let's get into some more, slightly more consumer-facing UK news. Not so much consumer tech, but certainly affects a lot of people. According to The Telegraph this week, traffic lights with embedded artificial intelligence could spell the end of rush hour queues in British cities. Now, that's a bit of an optimistic promise, if you ask me. You didn't, but I'll assume that you would have. According to the paper, Milton Keynes has become the first city to announce plans, at least, to install these so-called smart traffic lights. What they do is they detect heavy concentrations of vehicles, which obviously happens during traffic jams and things, and then alter the old the green, amber, red patterns to ease congestion. Now, I had actually assumed that traffic lights kind of did this already in some form, you know, when I was first reading the story. But then I thought, well, actually, it's going to be pretty hard to have been able to do this for the decades that these things have been in use. And I know that one of the people involved in the companies behind this AI system, they've said that there's very limited intelligence involved in the current management of roads. So I guess actually this is a pretty, it's a bit of a sea change, if you'll excuse the slightly mixed visual metaphor.
Very much so. But listen, so this is great. This could be great. Traffic lights are stupid, and so stupid, in fact, that it's actually quite painful to use them sometimes. There's one near me that I use on the way to take my son to nursery in the mornings. And what happens is it allows about two cars across. And it's infuriating because essentially, if it could see that there was, you know, if it could see that there were lots of cars there, then, you know, it would be think, well, okay, if I let all these cars go now, you know, there'll be less frustration. It won't affect the traffic flow too much because the other road will then be given, you know, loads of time to clear. And also, you'll often see that there are two traffic lights close together in this particular example, one on the left-hand turn. That means that it can get quite chocked up. So cars turning left will immediately then get caught at this second set of traffic lights, which blocks people from going, you know, going straight on and right. So if it was an AI system, if all those group of traffic lights were somehow managed together, you could see that the cars were sort of getting stacked up. Then you could do something about it. You could let some through, you know, in theory, this could be huge. And I think, in when we have self-driving cars, part of that will be all the cars will communicate with each other, all the traffic. Well, in fact, you won't even need traffic lights. We've talked about this before. When all the cars are just driving themselves, they'll be able to coordinate and they won't smash into each other at a crossroads. So you won't need traffic lights.
Milton Keynes has the backing of Innovate UK and Traxys, apparently investing £3 million in this technology. The Telegraph reported that the system should be operational by September next year. So if you're in Milton Keynes and you suddenly notice your traffic jams are alleviated by some form of non-physical entity that's guiding the road systems, do let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, according to the BBC this week, mobile phone users, of which we probably all are, will be able to switch network operators by sending a text. It's an SMS, ladies and gentlemen, to the provider that they want to leave. And this is under new plans drawn up by regulator Ofcom. Now, the regulator said customers could avoid, using this method, an awkward and long call to their operator and instead just send a text. In turn, they will then be sent back switching codes, which I presume would be similar to the PAC codes that we use today.
Usually, I find if you go into those phone calls saying, please don't ask me any questions, just give me the number. Because they know they're not going to get anything out of you if you say that. You just have to be really bullish about it and go, I'm not answering any questions, just give me the pack. Especially if you're all paid up and there's no reason for them not to.
Yeah.
I like this idea. I wrote about it yesterday, and I really like the idea. And I think that there's a lot of stuff in the idea that actually makes a lot of sense. Like, for example, a lot of people will get talked out of switching. For various promises, could we give you a new phone, blah, 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 even if that goes entirely against their best interests.
Is that a bad thing, though? I mean, that's one thing to consider, whether
having costs reduced. Well, you'll still be able to call. It won't go away. You'll still be able to ring up the retentions department and say, look, I mean, in some ways it might work out. You could be right. It might work out in against the consumer, because they will know that if people are calling the retentions department, they might only be half serious about it, if you see what I mean.
I do see what you mean.
And presumably there's nothing to stop the company from calling you once you've applied for your pack online, with your text messages. Presumably nothing to stop them from ringing you straight after that and going, is there anything we can do, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it'd be difficult to legislate against that. They're your mobile provider. They're usually quite able to call you for any reason they so choose, right?
That's true. And issuing a PAC code doesn't mean they're going to cut off your service. But the PAC code, I think, is valid for 30 days and simply allows you to go to a new provider and say, here's my PAC, but you don't have to use it.
No.
So I don't see any reason why they couldn't call you afterwards and say, hey, can we keep you?
That's right. And I mean, this I think changes it slightly, in that I think there are improvements to it to make it quicker, and I don't know if it's instant, if it can happen instantly, but I know that they have to provide a load of information within it as well. So they have to tell you if you've got any balances due on the account, if there's anything left to pay, all that kind of stuff, which is what kind of makes it useful. But I do wonder if, I can't remember from what I read from the Ofcom proposal, whether or not they were saying it would be somehow quicker. But most people are already going to be tied into a 30-day contract end anyway, aren't they? So it won't be able to affect that. So there'll still be a certain period of time.
Well, while this remains in proposition stage, nothing is going to change. Ofcom will make a final decision in the autumn this year. But I did read a really interesting figure that almost 6 million people who have a mobile phone contract in Britain, and there are 47 million of those people in total, have never switched providers. Which is not an insignificant number. And that could be for any number of reasons. It could be ignorance. It could be that they're just happy with their providers. Certainly, I remained with providers for many years. But it was very interesting that 6 million have never changed. What I do think is interesting about this story also is that this isn't the original proposition that I think Ofcom wanted. Originally, what they wanted was something that involved just a single step, where you basically just text or tell a new provider, hey, I want to move to you, this is my number, and they, your new provider, do all the back-end service. They go to your existing provider, they get the PAC code or whatever equivalent they have in the back-end, they tell them the cutoff date, and then your current provider tells you, hey, we know you're moving to such and such, here's your final bill, here's when your date of service will expire, blah, blah, blah. And that is actually what we have now for things like gas and electricity. You know, if you want to move to a new gas or electric supplier, you just go to the new one and say, hey, I'm signing up. This is my address. You do nothing else. They go to your existing provider, cancel everything. You do nothing with your existing provider.
Obviously, with that is that it is exactly the same electricity. So basically all you're doing is changing billing providers, really. And they are able, obviously, to negotiate deals on their own to get better prices for energy. But that's why that whole system is fundamentally stupid. I mean, you can change water providers, can't you, or something? Maybe you can't actually do that, but
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't remember having a choice when I moved.
I think you have a region. Yeah, you have a region, but it's no more stupid, really. I mean, gas is the same gas, the electricity is the same electricity.
Well, if you are excited by this plan to switch, or if you've had any really bad experiences recently switching mobile phone providers, we'd love to hear some examples. And I'll tell you something else I would love to hear. For those of you listening outside of the UK, it would be great to hear how your country's local rules affect your ability to switch mobile providers. If you've got some real horror stories, or if your system locally differs from what we've described having today or about to have here in the UK, do let us know. It'd be really interesting to compare and contrast those. podcast@nateslangson.com. Well, Ian, a little bit of sad news here, because we talked about this only about a year or so ago. The BBC is going to close its TV download store about a year, in fact, about a year and a half exactly almost, after it was opened. This, according to a report in The Telegraph. This is also apparently because it failed to hit its own commercial targets because of, in part, pressure from US streaming rivals such as Netflix, of course. Now, the store lets people buy digital copies of new and classic programmes. It was also linked to from the BBC iPlayer, you know, so an incredibly high-profile source of potential referrals for you to buy versions of things that would disappear off the iPlayer before too long. But a source told the newspaper that it's being prepared for closure simply because the rapid rise of subscription-based streaming services are also offering BBC programming and obviously also just getting incredibly popular. Ian, what are your initial thoughts on this? Because I think this is both maybe a little bit predictable, but also a little bit sad.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. I'll be honest. Because is it acceptable to not know?
Yes.
I kind of feel like they could just as easily sell it through other places. I don't think the BBC needs its own download store. Now, I understand that it might be slightly more financially efficient to have their own download store so that they can, you know, take a lot more of the profit. But I also sort of feel like it's probably so expensive to run a system like that in terms of staffing, in terms of producing the quality, you know, server costs and all that kind of thing. I sort of think that maybe it would be better if there weren't more stores and if there were fewer stores and stuff was more widely available. Now, I was thinking about this. I'm paying quite a lot now for various streaming services. And I don't ever sit down and think, oh, maybe it's time to have a little audit about this kind of thing. But it would definitely put me off buying stuff outright now. If it wasn't on Netflix or Amazon, I'd probably just think, meh, I won't bother. I'll wait. It'll turn up eventually. I used to be someone who had to see shows immediately.
Yes, so did I.
I don't really feel like that anymore. I don't have the time. You know, evenings are usually pretty much a disaster for me, mentally speaking. So I'll sit down to watch TV and then almost certainly just fall asleep. So for me, it's kind of like I'm a bit more picky about the sort of TV I watch now. And I don't mind waiting for it. And if I can avoid spoilers, that's usually fairly difficult. But also, I've come to grips with the fact that, hey, it happens. And as much as I hate it, you know, I will still derive some enjoyment from a TV program if it's had minor things spoiled. So perhaps I'm not the only person, but perhaps I'm not the best example of someone. But I kind of think that I can see why it failed, and I don't particularly care.
I think you're right in that the popularity of being able to buy BBC programming through other stores, like iTunes, for example. You can download, you know, what to me looks like every BBC program made. You can buy individual episodes of or series of from iTunes, and there are others obviously around. Yeah. And and Netflix as well. You know, a lot of BBC programming is on Netflix. Sure. You're not going to find the very latest. I've noticed that some series are absent. I vaguely remember when I watched Gavin and Stacey, which is not a program I ever thought I'd like, but I turned out to really like it. I remember noticing that something like only series 2 and 3 were on, and you know, series 1 wasn't available. So there are sometimes quirks like that. But I actually really love watching BBC programs on Netflix, and particularly documentaries, actually, because a lot of those are in HD. And yeah. when they were first broadcast, or perhaps when I just first watched them, they weren't in HD, or weren't broadcast in HD, or I couldn't watch them in HD. But now, if you can buy them in HD, that's fine, but the Blu-rays are quite expensive, and, you know, it's nice that there's such a great repository on Netflix of things like that. And I love that. And I think that that chimes with the reasoning that we've come up with today, that people are just using the combination of those streaming services and just going to buy stuff on things like iTunes, because they're yeah. easier. They don't have to think about, oh, how do I get this onto my device? And maybe that's there were enough hurdles there to stop it being a success.
This is the thing. I think Apple and... you know who else I think is really good at delivering stuff like this is Google. If you go to the Google Play Store for buying video, it's actually a really good experience. It's very simple. It works well. The quality is pretty decent. And it's all in one place. And it works on Android and it works on iPhone. And it also works on Android TV, obviously. So that means for me, I use a Shield. I can watch a Google...
ladies and gentlemen, what Ian is saying here is that he uses the NVIDIA or NVIDIA Shield. What he doesn't do is sit around with a sword and shield on his sofa, watching TVs, fending off advertisers with the force of his 15-inch iron.
I assume that our tech-savvy audience would have probably heard of it, but that's probably wrong. It's a streaming box, yes. It's called the NVIDIA Shield, as Nate constantly reminds me of the one mistake I made once. and has not let me forget about it for, I don't know, 10 years?
Yeah, easily 10 years. I look forward to another 10, mate.
Ah, brilliant. I can't wait for us to be in our dotage with you going, oh, I remember that time when you mispronounced not a word.
Oh, anyway. God, back in the day, it was all NVIDIA this and AMD that.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, that Google Store is really good, and I would like to continue using it. iTunes, as much as I like my iPhone and iPad, I don't have an Apple TV. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense for me. That's what I'd look for. If I was going to buy a BBC program or any other program, I'd look on Google first.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the reasons why I do hope that down the line, companies like Google and Apple for their respective download stores might be able to come up with some sort of subscription model where you can have a kind of a la carte or you can eat access to TV programming like we have with music. It's very unlikely that will happen anytime soon. But my goodness, would that make a huge difference to how much people might be prepared to pay per month on TV and movie programming versus what they're paying per month now, which for me is, you know, months go by when I don't pay anything because I'm just streaming things. Now, a BBC source told The Telegraph quite literally that the download market just isn't what it once was. And that stands to reason, I think. I think that makes sense. Apparently, also, the BBC is developing alternative plans to commercialize its archive. Now, we've talked in the past about its close developmental relationships with BritBox. Now, that's the US-only subscription streaming service. It's a joint venture between ITV and the BBC. It is only available in the US, and we talked about that in an episode in March. But apparently there are plans, or were plans, to sort of have the US launch as something of a precursor to a UK launch of BritBox. But that's been put a little bit on ice, I think, because ITV CEO very recently quit. Very successful CEO, from what I read as well. So they're sort of in search for a new CEO, and you know, deals like this are going to be delayed because of that. But for now, it seems, ladies and gentlemen, it is all iTunes, all Google, and all Netflix if you want your BBC download content. Or streaming content. Let us know any thoughts you have, of course. podcast@nateslangson.com. Now, before we get into a couple of other stories and some more emails, we had such a lot of email over the last 3 or 4 weeks that we just didn't have time to get to most of them. So we wanted to get through a couple in the middle of the show here first. And one came from somebody who, for deliberately or otherwise, didn't leave a name. So I'm afraid I don't know who sent this. But the unknown sender wanted to defend Opera, the browser, because we did talk about it a little bit a couple of weeks ago.
And we trash talked it, didn't we?
Well, sort of. I mean, I've always thought Opera was fantastic. I think the technology underpinning Opera is tremendous, and I think they make one of the best mobile browsers you can get and have done for a decade. And I think Opera Mini back in the day when you're on an N95 or something, or a N95 to continue the teasing, Chief.
Well, I don't think I ever said that, did I?
No, but I just assumed one day you would. So I just thought I'd throw it in there. We can't expect it now. They don't make them anymore. Anyway, but I thought back then, Opera Mini, which, you know, unlimited 3G connections with expensive data plans, you know, you had 30 megabytes a month for about 90 quid. It would compress data on the server side of a website before sending it to your phone. So it was great technology, but I've always said that I think their place in the desktop world is not necessarily where they need to be, and they should focus on mobile. This email came in then, we'll finally get to it, who says, I would just like to say a few words in defense of the Opera browser. My laptop is quite spec. I'm not sure what that means. I think quite... maybe low spec. I wish I could afford a better one. I've tried nearly every browser. Chrome is so heavy it can literally crash my machine. Firefox is slow and needs patience. Slimjet is quite good, but can still become a little unresponsive. I've never even heard of Slimjet. However, Opera has been a joy to use. It's fast, stable, and I can use all the Chrome extensions. They say, I've been listening to text messages for years. I understand the views expressed are from personal experience. They are. And my personal experience is that Opera is a very, very good browser, desktop browser. I still have it installed on my machine, and I use it from time to time just to keep on top of the things they integrate. And I think that they've got some great tech. I just think that, you know, given the competition in the desktop browsing space and given Opera's legacy of innovating on the mobile side, like, they really stand a chance at being the de facto go-to mobile browser if they wanted to, but hey ho. We've got another email. This one came in from Warren. He says, catching up on an old show from about a month ago when you were talking about contactless payments. Ian mentioned that he only uses his phone for payments up to £30. I don't know about Android Pay, but with Apple Pay, there is, depending on the retailer, no contactless limit due to the biometric authentication. For example, I regularly pay for the weekly shop in Sainsbury's with Apple Pay. I was in an Apple store a couple of months ago getting a screen repaired, also paid with Apple Pay, £120 or so. And the Apple chap I was dealing with said that someone had bought an Aston Martin with Apple Pay. he puts in parentheses, hearsay, so do I need to add allegedly? No, you don't. I think that's fine. But I think it's true. And Samsung Pay launched in the UK this week. And I had a briefing with them for a story I was writing for Bloomberg. And, you know, they said, again, you know, the contactless limit is at the retailer's discretion because biometrics do allow you to sort of override the limitations enforced on debit cards where you don't need to prove you're the owner. And are therefore limited at 30 quid. So there is development here. Certainly buying a car is a bit of a push, isn't it? But nonetheless, it's a good development.
Not if you can afford it. Like, I mean, if you're one of these people that say has an American Express card, American Express debit cards, not debit cards, American Express charge cards often don't have limits, I believe, which is why they're fairly difficult to get. But certainly there are credit cards that have very, very high limits for very, very rich people. So it makes sense. I mean, you know, as long as everyone's happy that the security is there, it's probably no worse than... I would say that the security involved in buying a car would be such that it would be very inadvisable to do it if you weren't the actual owner of the card, you know, because it would just be an easy way to get caught, wouldn't it? So it makes perfect sense.
Well, thank you to both of you for your opinions sent in to podcast@natelangson.com. A few more coming up in a little bit. Let's return to the news, though. And according to industry website The Bookseller, I'm just going to touch on this quickly, Amazon has launched Prime Reading in the UK, which marks the first time that this perk to the Amazon Prime subscription has been made available outside of the US since its launch there last October. What is Prime Reading, you may wonder? Apparently, I didn't know this, it provides a periodically updated selection of about 1,000 books for Kindle, including magazines and some short stories, comics, children's books, I think. And they're all part of your existing Amazon Prime subscription. So essentially, if you've got Prime and you've got a way to read something from the Kindle service, you're now getting this. So you're getting free books to read every month. Ars Technica had a story as well about this, and they said that some of the included titles for the UK at launch include The Hobbit, the first Harry Potter book, something called When I'm Gone. Don't know what that is, but it sounds depressing. The Complete Peanuts collection, which I assume is the comic strip and not something about salted snack food. And Transformers, Robots in Disguise, Volume 1, which I'm assuming is a child's book, but I imagine lots of adults read that too. There's also magazines, National Geographic, Wired, Women's Weekly, Time, Men's Health, Glamour. You can read those magazines without having subscriptions to those publications. So it seems like a neat idea. I've never used it, but I'll be interested in hearing if anybody has been using it and whether this is actually a real value add or the kind of thing trotted out by big companies to get a bit of bonus PR when they're between product release cycles, or in this case, actually coincidentally with product release, because they brought some new Kindle Fires that have Alexa in them to the UK this week too, which you're not going to talk about because you can summarize it in a sentence.
And you just did, in fact.
I did, in fact, yes. And if you missed that, if you rewind just a little bit, you'll notice it was just before Ian's quip. So this is pretty this is pretty cool. Thanks, Amazon. Let us know if you have any thoughts, everybody. Podcast@natelangson.com. Go on, Ian. Give me a comment.
Well, I was going to try it, and I didn't. I probably will.
Good. Well, valuable insights there. We had a related email from Lewis, actually, from a couple of weeks ago that, again, we weren't able to get to over the last couple of shows, but it was relevant to talk about it here. It was, we had talked about the value of printed books versus ebooks and things, you know, that old argument. And Lewis says, born in the 60s and have been reading as long as I can remember. Needless to say, I started with printed books. Since getting my first iPad with a Retina screen, I've pretty much entirely given up on printed books. In fact, I have a stack of books that has been growing for about 5 years that I haven't read solely because I don't have them in ebook format. Lewis says, I do use a Kindle sometimes, but I use the iPad the most. And he also says that he listens to audiobooks, but for less than about 10% of his quote-unquote reading. So this is almost certainly the kind of service that somebody like Lewis would benefit from checking out, assuming they have a Prime subscription, because it's all behind that giant annual paywall that is the sort of... what is it? Digital, physical, hybrid subscription service from the future. Anyway, any more thoughts on this? Very welcome, everybody. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, that's it for the news this week. We've got just one more email that I wanted to get to before we close out the show. A little longer one, this came in from Nick. We talked a great deal over the last month about mobile phones and how we treat them in social situations over dinner at home with kids. Do we use them too much? Are we addicted to just mindlessly checking social feeds when we could be doing something creative? You know, not judgmentally discussed, but, you know, we have our own personal stances on that. So Nick emailed in with one of his experiences, as we asked some people to do. He says, the use of phones thing is interesting. As an up to until quite recently single bloke who lives on his own, I probably exhibit a higher than typical use of my phone. This was highlighted to me recently while on holiday with my extended family. I spent a week staying with my parents and my brother and his family. Being among a group of chaotic people was a huge contrast to my usual everyday life, but the nice thing that came out of it was being able to spend some time with people dear to me. One of the highlights of this was as all having dinner together each evening and then spending a couple of hours playing cards and having a laugh. I'll admit that I spent a good deal of time messaging my now girlfriend, and my teenage nephew spent quite a lot of time on his phone too. Somehow it seemed more okay for him to do it, being 14, when I'm 43 and should know better or have more self-control. Your analogy of the 1950s father reading the paper is completely valid. That really is no different to us all being absorbed by our own little curated worlds on our phones. We get absorbed by things which we are interested in. And it's not really any different to the 1980s family sitting around eating their dinners off their lap while they or sit silently watching TV. There's no social interaction, even if there is a commonly shared experience in that instance. The difference with the smartphone is it's portable, so it allows us to multitask. We can engage in our little curated worlds in our hands, and somehow it's okay to do this while we're supposed to be engaging with the important things around us. The fact is, it isn't really okay. It's actually really bloody rude, and it's frankly a bit sad that we've all become instant gratification junkies, resulting in us all being addicted to social media notifications, with this constant feeling like we need to be fully engaged with the virtual world around us. During one of our evenings on holiday, my brother lost his rag and had a right old rant about the use of mobile phones at the table, and he was right. I'm just a bit too used to my own space and own rules when I'm at home on my own. And it did make me think about my usage and think about whether or not it really is enriching my life to the extent that I'm allowing it to dilute the experience of spending time with people dear to me. That's from Nick. So a really personal experience, really honest. So you know, appreciate that, Nick. It's a good insight. If you have good insights on anything we've talked about today, obviously you can send them to us, podcast@natelangson.com, or send them to us at Twitter @textmessagepod. And just before you do that, let's check in with the last week's worth of global tech news and what you can hear listening to Tom Merritt on Daily Tech News Show. Tom, what's going on?
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This week on DTNS, we talked about why you might want a bot in your Skype video calls. You might. We discussed whether your National Health Service there in the UK should have helped DeepMind with personally identifiable medical info, discussed all the AI news out of Google I.O., discussed the facts as we know them around the U.S. net neutrality debate, and speculated whether audio can save Medium. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
Great stuff, Tom. Another fantastic week, I think, there in tech discussion. And that's it from us as well for this episode 99. The next time you hear us, it'll be from a live studio in London for episode 100. My goodness, am I going to be glad when that's over. I'll be honest. It's stressing me out thinking about this whole bloody thing.
I can imagine.
But it's going to be amazing. It'll be great to meet some of the listeners. And you know, thanks to everyone who put themselves forward to come to the show on Twitter and by emailing in. It's going to be fantastic. So excited. Ian, I think that's it, isn't it, mate? I think we're done.
I think so, yeah.
Right. Toodle-pip, everybody. See you in the studio.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.